Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Debate night in America? Yes, but is there other stuff going on? Also, yes, that's why we're here. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 26th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Hey, what are you doing tonight? Anything? All right, yes, there is that very first presidential debate tonight, Hofstra University out on Long Island, 9 p.m. in the East, here with our primer on that section of this evening's discussion that the Debate Commission has labeled Achieving Prosperity. First, Hillary Clinton's senior policy advisor, his name is Jacob Liebenluft. He was on this program about 10 days ago.
She recognizes that 95% of the world's customers are outside the United States. And that's part of the reason she's focused so much on making real investments in things like infrastructure and manufacturing and innovation, elements that make us more competitive and able to more effectively sell our products to the rest of the world.
And in response or counterpoint, really, one should probably say, Donald Trump's senior trade advisor, his name is Dan DiMicco. We talked to him last week.
Mr. Trump's entire economic plan, including his trade policy, are designed to increase our global competitiveness. That doesn't mean we're going to move away from globalization. There's no chance of that. Globalization is here to stay, but it's gotten to an extreme to where now it's doing more harm than good.
Lots of trade talk tonight. Bet you dollars to donuts. Again, it's 9 o'clock in the East. We will be working. Join me and our reporters for analysis and live tweeting. Marketplace.org is where you can go for that. You can get me straight away on Twitter if you like. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. I do Snapchat, too. Well, I lurk there, to be totally honest. But there is news of that company that is worth mention today. First of all, it has changed its name. It's now Snap Inc., probably because it's out with its first wearable, a pair of sunglasses that can record video as well, which you would then, in theory, share with your followers, or so the business model goes. We got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the line to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Guy.
Are you going to wear these $130 Snapchat sunglasses?
I'm not 100% sure that I'm going to wear them. I'm more in the 70 to 80% range,
really?
But my kid is 100% going to wear them.
Wow. All right. That's so telling on a whole lot of levels. But let's run through this, first of all, just the corporate part of this thing. They are now Snap Inc., and their first hardware product is these sunglasses that can record, like, what, 10 or 30 seconds of videos?
They can record 30 seconds of videos. To be fair, purists will tell you it's not really their first hardware product. They also did a plushie and a beach towel. But no, this is definitely a sign that Snapchat is branching in a much broader direction, understanding that, you know, there's only so long that Snapchat alone, the sort of fun messaging company, can sustain you. And they're doing this kind of really interesting and I think I would argue very related growth strategy into capture. Into cameras.
Okay, but wait, because the last time we had a big company making things that you can put on your face, it didn't go so well, Google Glass.
That is true. A couple of things about that. One, a lot of times in the history of technology, the first thing that comes along is not the thing that people are ready for. It is too expensive and it doesn't work well. And all three of those things were true with Google Glass. It was incredibly expensive. It was horrible as a functioning product. And it was so earnest. It had a completely different agenda. And that agenda was, you know, life cast everything and constantly have access to all the information. It was sort of like an external implant
from
Google. Right. And these Snap spectacles are none of that. They are meant to be purely fun. They are overtly silly in terms of design. You're not going to try to fool anybody by wearing them. And they only do 30 seconds of video. So I think they have a much more focused aim, which is what Google Glass could have used. They're pretty cheap at $130. And frankly, they almost have to work better than Google Glass.
Well, but wait, because isn't what Snapchat is doing here the thing that Google tried to do, which is make our lives something that will now be lived in front of a camera, if that makes any sense, right? It's a lifestyle-changing kind of thing.
It absolutely is. And I think that is the part that people are going to have to get comfortable with or not. They may not. Google Glass really made people feel invaded. It came into their world and somebody was wearing glasses and you didn't know if they were reading tweets, taking your picture, or looking at porn while you were in conversation with them.
Ew.
It's probably happened. That's less of an issue with these spectacles because all people are doing is taking a 30-second video of the things in front of them. There may still be those sort of privacy concerns, but I think you could argue that as a society, we have become those people. We're recording everything all the time. Huh. And there's no reason to assume. We've just assumed that that had to happen on a phone because that was the most common mobile device with a camera in it. But it doesn't.
So once again, are you going to wear them or not?
I'm going to get some. I think they're pretty funny.
All right. Molly Wood, she's our senior tech correspondent. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
Molly had a great discussion with David Brancaccio on the Morning Report this morning, by the way, that I want to tell you about. It was about the guy who invented Oculus, the virtual reality headset that he then sold to Facebook for $2 billion. Palmer Luckey is his name. Internet trolling is his new thing, and not in a good way. Molly had some really interesting thoughts. It's at the Heard on Air link on our website. Check it out. The thoughts on Wall Street today did not lend themselves to the happy music. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The centerpiece of President Obama's climate change plan is going to be on the docket in a courtroom in Washington, D.C. tomorrow in what one of the lawyers calls an environmental case for the ages. In the American economy, one industry spits out the most greenhouse gases: electricity, power generation. The Obama administration's blueprint for greening those power plants, basically getting them to burn less coal, is called the Clean Power Plan. And that is what all the lawyering is going to be about tomorrow. So from the sustainability desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong is on it.
The coal industry and more than two dozen states are challenging the rule. It gives every state an emissions target. And the overall goal is to cut U.S. greenhouse gas output by one third. Now, here's a key legal question for tomorrow. Can the EPA regulate beyond an actual power plant and try to green up the broader power grid? It's an untested question, says UCLA law professor Kara Horowitz.
This section of the Clean Air Act, which is Section 111, has not been relied on very often. So the court will be wading into statutory questions that really haven't been answered before, and that's partly why it's such an exciting case.
A case before a federal appeals court. But it probably won't end there, as the Supreme Court has already nosed its way in. Attorney Tom Lorenzen will argue for electric companies against the EPA. He says the Supreme Court has halted this rule, even though it was being argued in a lower court.
It was something that the Supreme Court had never done before. So I think that indicates the court is very interested in this case and is quite likely to take it up eventually.
Now, outside the courthouse, the energy markets are changing fast. Coal is being nudged out by cleaner gas, and wind and solar energy can now compete against both. So the market could do the EPA's job, says analyst John Larson at the Rhodium Group. He sees the Clean Power Plan as a backup.
It's kind of an insurance policy. I think what you're really doing is reinforcing the direction that the market's already taking us.
At least for now. Energy prices can be as unpredictable as courts of law. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Men who get prostate cancer have traditionally had three options: surgery, radiation, or basically wait and see. A report out earlier this month shows there's no real difference between the three when it comes to death rates, which obviously has an effect on what patients and doctors decide and on what insurance companies might decide to pay for. From the Health Desk, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has more on that.
A month ago, Mark Biagini picked up the phone.
I called friends of mine and my family. I have a brother and sister and my mom.
Biagini told them all he has prostate cancer. He's 49, a chiropractor in Pittsburgh. Since he's got the word, Biagini's had long nights going round and round about what's next.
Is it better to have it cured, or at least try to have it cured and deal with the side effects, or is it better to see what happens and not deal with the side effects? It's a tough choice.
Wait and see is becoming a real approach. As many as half the patients are going that route these days. The new research on prostate cancer adds to growing evidence. Here in the U.S., we do too much on men with slow-growing tumors. Even the head doctor at the American Cancer Society, Dr. Otis Brawley, thinks so.
We know that the majority of those men don't need to be treated. They don't even need to know they have prostate cancer.
Brawley hopes this new research persuades even more prostate cancer patients to wait and see, but he's got his doubts. He says it's hard to recruit people for randomized trials because they're afraid they'll be in the group that doesn't get treatment. That makes sense to Dr. Ben Davies, one of Mark Biagini's physicians in Pittsburgh. Some patients, he says, freak out when they hear the C word, cancer.
Most of them, frankly, to be totally honest, just want to be treated and move on with their life.
Another challenge to cutting back? The doctors. Patients almost always do what their doctors recommend. In fact, one study suggests they go with their physician 85% of the time.
Most of the time, when physicians were making recommendations, they suggested that patients get surgery or radiation.
That's Duke Medical School student Karen Schur and lead author of the study. Some doctors may steer their patients toward more aggressive treatment because they'll make more money, but Schur observed physicians who are salaried, so no financial incentive. She thinks, just like the patients, physicians are worried too.
It's really scary to recommend something when there's a chance that a cancer could spread and a patient could lose the opportunity of a cure. Even if it's unlikely, it feels really emotionally hard to recommend such a thing.
So if we're going to change the way Americans deal with this kind of cancer, a lot of the weight may fall to doctors. And here's the thing. The U.S. is on track to spend more than $14 billion this year fighting prostate cancer. A chunk of that may help patients and doctors psychologically, but it's not helping people live any longer, at least at 10 years out. But that is a challenge for another day. In the here and now, 49-year-old Mark Biagini has choices to make.
I'm leaning towards waiting for a while and seeing how aggressive it is before I make my decision to jump into the surgery.
After an MRI came back showing nothing ominous, Biagini huddled with one of his doctors and, yes, took a look at the study and decided to hold off for now. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we disrupted an industry that we really loved.
What morning TV and email have in common. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 166 points, 0.9%, 18,094. The NASDAQ off 48 points, also 0.9%, 52.57. The S&P 500 lost 18 points, 0.8%, 21.46. Pfizer flagged 1.8% today on news it's not going to be splitting into two smaller companies. Bristol-Myers Squibb fizzled 1.75%. Rough day in big pharma overall. Financials lost as well. Deutsche Bank gave up 7.5%. German news magazine is reporting that the German government isn't going to bail it out. Bank of America yielded 2.75%. Citigroup down 2.75% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 1.58%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The federal trial of Emin and Ryan Bundy continues this week in Portland, Oregon. The Bundys and their associates are charged with leading the armed takeover of that wildlife refuge in eastern Oregon earlier this year. The Bundys have a strict interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, one that calls for a turnover of federal lands in the West to local and private control. Still, though, as Mitchell Hartman reports from our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, government has a hold on that region that reaches beyond the land to people's jobs and pocketbooks.
The small town of Goldendale in central Washington sits on a dry, windswept plateau in a county where more than one in four jobs is a government job. Neil Slater is 60 and firmly rooted in the private sector as a fourth-generation rancher. He also earns money training horses and volunteers training teenagers to handle horses in a summer rodeo Bible camp at the county fairgrounds.
I coach the heading and the team roping, and then we've got goat tie and barrel racing.
Slater is a conservative Republican, and he agrees with the Bundys that the federal government doesn't have a constitutional right to own or manage most land in the West. He thinks government bureaucrats just don't get how people survive out here.
We got people putting rules and regulations in place that have nothing to do, no attachment to the land.
But he's got a dilemma because he also benefits from some of those rules and regulations to graze his 200 head of cattle.
With programs that government funded, some of them are really good. Me, myself, we've drilled 3 wells with assistance that we've got solar panels on, got water where we didn't have water, which really helps.
And the federal workers who administer that U.S. Department of Agriculture program here?
In our government office here, we have some really good people. We have several farmers' wives that actually work in there to keep their farms going and stuff, and they're great to work with.
Damon Runberg is an economist at the Oregon Employment Department in Bend, about 150 miles south of Goldendale. And he says this big federal footprint is a common pattern across the West.
In general, we see a correlation with the higher the percentage of the land covered in public land, the higher the employment base would be in public employment.
And among the highest prevalence of government jobs in Oregon, Harney County, site of the recent Western Land Rebellion. 49% of jobs are in federal, state, or local government, from Forest Service firefighters to local school teachers to Bureau of Land Management accountants. Compare that to urban Portland with around 13% government jobs. In Burns, the Harney County seat, I meet Chris Bryles. He's the former fire chief here, and he organized a local support group for the Bundys. He acknowledges a lot of his neighbors make their living in government agencies.
When the environmentalists and everybody shut down all the logging, people had to have jobs of some kind.
But he still wants all the federal land turned over to local control and most of the related state and federal jobs eliminated.
And take the resources that are within the county and manage them by people that live here in the county.
Just down the street, I sat down at a local coffee shop with Isabel Floreau. Her husband is a USDA scientist who does research at the wildlife refuge. Families like hers on the federal payroll have above-average incomes for the region and get health and retirement benefits many in agriculture and ranching lack.
Antagonism against the federal government is palpable. Although it is a ranching community, it is a fact that the public sector drives the economy here.
Scott Cooper is a former county judge and now runs Central Oregon's biggest social service agency, two-thirds funded by state and federal government. He says many locals can't make a living off the land, logging or ranching anymore, and then they see government workers managing that land and living pretty well.
I think it's a logical consequence of poverty that was created right after the loss of the federal land base for a lot of industry. People are poor and they're hurting and they're angry and they're looking for somebody to blame it on.
Cooper says there's not much private sector job growth forecast for these rural counties, meaning government jobs will be a major engine of the economy for years to come. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Not that the New York Times is the be-all and end-all of the news business, but it does have a certain cachet. So when it invests in a company built, at least in the beginning, on a chatty but very newsy morning email aimed at millennial women, people pay attention. The Daily Skim is what the newsletter's called. I read it. The company is called The Skim. It was started 4 years ago by Daniel Weisberg and Carly Zakin, who quit their jobs as producers for NBC News to do it. The Times announcement came this morning, part of an $8 million round of financing that's going to get the company into video. Daniel Weisberg and Carly Zakin are the co-founders, as I said, also the co-CEOs of The Skim. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having us. Excited to be here.
Danielle, I think it was you. I was reading up before I came into the studio. You said at a conference or something not too long ago that your newsletter...
Uh-oh.
Yeah, well, no, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. And it goes to the whole riff of what this enterprise is. Your newsletter, The Daily Skim, to which, as I said in the introduction, I am a subscriber and a reader. You're welcome. It is the third ranked morning television show. Explain what you meant and why that matters.
So I think that, you know, what we were saying is that if you look at us, we have well over 3.5 million active subscribers on our newsletter, and our engagement is really unprecedented. And we're giving people hard news every day. And if you compare that to, you know, what is traditionally the way that people have gotten information in the morning and look at morning television, we're really on that scale. So we just found a different way to introduce that same idea that people want to get information from a source they trust first thing in the morning.
Carly, talk to me for a second about that thing that Danielle mentioned, engagement rates. I mean, what's the open rate on this email? It must be astronomical, right?
Yeah, so we're very proud to talk about our open rate. You know, industry average for a product like ours really ranges from about 12 to 19%, and in some cases 7%. Mm-hmm. And our open rate is well around 35%. Mm-hmm. And what we really prided ourselves on is our company really has two assets. It's our voice that is, you know, very distinctive for anyone who notices and reads the skim and engages with it. But the other is this community that we've built, and that really goes to show why there's so much engagement around the daily product.
Carly, the thing is, though, that while you guys intentionally went after the millennial female, right, you also somehow have people who are not millennial females like me. Explain
well, we're
that.
Happy to have you.
Yeah, and I'm happy.
Yes.
And I'm happy to be there. But what's the secret sauce, right? I mean, how did that happen, do you think?
So I think, you know, when we approached the skim from the beginning, there was sort of one thing that we came up against, which is when we told our idea to people, they were like, why are you focusing on such a niche market? And our response was, women are not a niche market. For us, you know, the skim is not women's news for women. It is, we have a very clear audience in mind when we write this newsletter every day, when we create our suite of products every day. And that's what keeps our voice, I would say, fresh, and then what keeps our voice focused. But we're not curating these types of stories that is just for our audience. We're really happy and proud that 20% of our audience is men. And we really are filling the void for busy people on the go. And that's not gender specific and that's not age specific. But we definitely know who we're creating products for.
This is a toss up, and I'll let whichever one of you wants to answer it, answer it. Are you two now entrepreneurs or are you journalists?
Entrepreneurs.
I think we're definitely entrepreneurs, but I also don't think you can be both.
Yeah,
I think
you
that's
totally
what we
can.
Are.
You totally can.
Yeah. So yeah. I think I'm going to reject your question.
It's always good when the premise of the question gets rejected. That's fine.
Yeah. I mean, I think we definitely started off as journalists. We did this because we love news. And, you know, we saw the industry was changing and it kind of depressed us that the jobs that, you know, we thought we had or that we thought we would want didn't exist in the same way.
Right.
So we started our own path. So I think that makes us entrepreneurial in the way that we disrupted an industry that we really loved.
Okay. So if you are disruptors, and I grant you that point, I will not reject your premise.
Thank you.
Are you now, though, with you've got this skim ahead thing, you've got a skim app, you're opening, you've just gotten $8 million from Fox to do skim studios. Are you now sort of becoming, if not more traditional media, but certainly more mainstream in the media world?
I think we're very big. I think that's the difference.
Snap.
I think it's, you know, for a while, our whole story was we started it from our couch and we're the little engine that could
right.
and we're scrappy and we didn't have a business background. And that is something that is so authentic. That is who we are. Except for now, you know, we have a multi-platform audience company and we're really bringing our vision to life. And it's not just in one product. It's really a movement.
Do you still think you're a startup or are you past that now?
We're still a startup. I think that is so part of our culture and so part ingrained in how we started this company. We talk to our team all the time. You know, we're 33 people now, and we talk all the time that this company was founded on hustle. And whether we're 33 people, three people, or end up being 133 people, hustle will always be a part of our culture. And to me, that's inherent with startups. So, you know, we like to say that we're a company that started on the couch. We definitely have more couches now than the one tiny one that we started on. But we're definitely still a startup.
Daniel Weisberg and Carly Zakin, they are the co-founders and co-CEOs of The Skim. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This final note on the way out today, I am never going to be mistaken for anybody's musical tastemaker, but this isn't terrible, right?
Good day, sunshine in the backseat car. I wish that road could never stop.
I mean, yes, it's a tad cliche, but not bad for a computer, right? It's the first pop song released by artificial intelligence computers at the Sony Research Lab. Credit to the folks at Quartz for spotting it. There is another tune. You might want to check it out as well. The link is at marketplace.org. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it is terrible. The Dow off 166 points today, 0.9%, 18,094. The NASDAQ off 48 points, also 0.9%. The S&P 500 down 18 points, that is 0.8%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Robert Gurova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. Don't forget the debate tonight, marketplace.org. You can get me on Twitter, at Kai Rizdahl. Should be an interesting evening. We are back here tomorrow, everybody. See you later. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.